Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. The first case this morning is Phillips v. Sheriff of Cook County. Mr. Flaxman.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court. This case is about dental care at the Cook County Jail. After an eight-day trial on our application for injunctive relief, the district court found that class members were suffering unnecessary pain. The evidence at trial showed two widespread causes for the unnecessary pain. The first was that there was no face-to-face assessment by a registered nurse immediately or the day after the prisoner or the detainee filed or submitted a health service request complaining about dental pain. That's something that the county had promised to do back in 2012 in the consent decree case, the CRIPA case, when the medical monitor criticized that practice and the county said, we're going to start having face-to-face assessments by registered nurses. And I think the evidence showed that they do that, but not for people who are complaining of dental pain. Dental pain health service request forms are sent to the dentist where a dental technician who can't assess or provide treatment looks over the forms and then tries to prioritize them. The second problem identified at the trial was that there were problems in scheduling return visits to clinics. Somebody would see the dentist who would do some kind of procedure and say, come back in a week for a follow-up, and an appointment would be scheduled in a week, and then a clerk in the scheduling department would change that schedule, and the prisoner would not get to see the dentist in for a month. We identified those issues in our post-trial memorandum for the district court and asked for specific injunctive relief on the first practice, a refusal to give face-to-face assessments by a registered nurse or a higher-level practitioner following receipt of a health service request form. The district judge did not make any findings adverse to her core finding that class members were continuing to suffer necessary pain, but the district judge concluded that the case could not proceed as a class action under Rule B2 because there were two separate causes for detainees' prolonged dental pain. That's at page 17 of her opinion. In the view of a district judge, Walmart versus Dukes changed Rule 23A2 so that the questions in Rule 23A2 really means a single question, and that if you have more than one common question of fact or law, in the view of a district judge, there can't be a class action.
Well, so, and that kind of gets to the heart of it, because I'm concerned with how the injunction you propose provides relief to every inmate experiencing pain who didn't see a dentist within 7 days of reporting the pain.
What the injunction we proposed was was narrowly tailored to the violation we proved at trial in accordance with the PLRA. We said in our post-trial memorandum that there isn't enough in the record. We haven't gotten full discovery. We don't know what changes have been made since discovery closed about changes to say what other relief there should be, but we know we've identified this one problem, and you should grant us that relief, and you should reopen discovery and let us to have further proceedings for other relief.
Well, do you agree that there's no longer a policy at the jail that directly causes delays in dental treatment, and it's now more of a failure to follow the policies?
No, I do not agree. In the view of a district judge, once you have seven dentists, there are no problems for dental pain, because you have enough dentists. We have some dispute with the way on which the district judge made that finding that if you have seven, that's the optimum number. But what we presented in the Rule 60B motion was that we don't have seven full-time dentists. We have seven half-time dentists. The dentists say that we work 5 days a week. We see 15 patients a day. That's 75 patients a week, or about 150 patients in 2 weeks. In the Rule 60B motion, we presented the report of the medical monitor in the CRIPA litigation who said, you know, dentists see 155 patients every month. So instead of having seven full-time dentists, we have seven half-time dentists. And that's a serious problem. If you really need seven to provide dental care to everybody at the jail, we only have 3.5. So I'm not conceding that everything is fine now. And we're looking at what the jail is doing now.
It's a lot better than it was.
Excuse me?
You would concede it's a lot better than it was.
When they had one dentist and you had to wait a year to see a dentist and then your tooth would get pulled, it's a lot better than it was. But it's still causing gratuitous pain to prisoners, detainees who can't go to the dentist, who can't even go to the medicine chest and get ibuprofen because their tooth hurts. They can buy a small amount of painkiller at the commissary, but they really can't get enough to deal with their pain, and they can't get assessed promptly to see a dentist. That's what this case is about. It might be better than it was, but it's not good enough.
And I'm still trying to focus on the injunctive relief you want. So what if an inmate got a face-to-face evaluation within 24 hours and got the follow-up appointments needed, but the pain was attributable to some other policy?
If that's happening, if the record shows that, then we lose. But the record showed, at least the record at the trial back in June of 2014, showed that wasn't happening. That nurses were not doing face-to-face assessments of somebody complaining of dental pain. If you complained of chest pains, you would see a nurse. If you complained that you were having suicidal ideations, you would see a mental health worker. But if you complained of dental pain, the form would be sent to the dental clinic where a dental technician would prioritize it. And the evidence at trial showed really clearly but that's not a good way to assess dental pain. Many of the people at the jail do not have good written communication skills, and they're not able to clearly express the nature of their pain. Those who are clearly able to express the nature of their pain would be inclined to exaggerate and get to see a doctor, a dentist, promptly. What you need is a face-to-face, and the evidence, I think Dr. Raba, who's a dentist, testified that you need a face-to-face assessment to see whether this is serious, to see whether it's real. And that's what we asked for in the injunctive relief. We also asked for an expansion of the record to find out what's going on now and an appointment of a monitor pursuant to the PLRA. The district judge said, I don't have authority to appoint the monitor. Congress gave her that authority. The district judge said, who's going to pay for the monitor? Congress set out in the PLRA who pays for the monitor.
But so then on this, what prevented you from seeking discovery earlier?
Discovery closed in December of 2013.
Because the district court noted in several orders that you sat on the disclosures for almost a year in terms of the people that you wanted to have deposed.
That's
right up to the cutoff.
I'm not sure if the court is able to microscopically view the litigation. We filed the request for injunctive relief, I think, in December of 2013. We wanted to depose the people who saw the registered nurses who should have conducted the face-to-face assessments. We were told it's too late, discovery's closed, and you can't take the depositions of those people. And the defense will tell you, well, we gave the plaintiffs five depositions to find out what's happening, but those had been previously scheduled of policymakers. During the course of the trial, we got these memos from the new director of oral health at the jail about how the scheduling system is broken, and we don't know what she's talking about. That was given to us after discovery closed. We were not able to find out what she was talking about. But the point isn't so much that discovery was curtailed or unfair. The point is that the district judge said there cannot be a class because there's more than one question. And I don't know how to grant any kind of injunctive relief, which should be wrong, because we pointed out the narrow relief that we wanted after the hearing, the face-to-face assessment, and we said we need further proceedings to see what other relief should be narrowly tailored for the constitutional violations we've shown. The district judge agreed that class members are suffering unnecessary pain. There was a way to remedy that by having that face-to-face assessment by an RN or higher level practitioner who can give you ibuprofen. The evidence in this record is that ibuprofen is effective for dental pain, but you can't get that unless you see an RN. And the defendant's policy was that nurses would not conduct face-to-face assessments of people complaining of dental pain. If once a district judge said that it's inappropriate to have a class and decertify the class, she didn't have jurisdiction to adjudicate the merits. And I think the same is true here, that this court cannot affirm on alternate grounds. The court has to first reach the, is there a class? Was the district judge wrong on whether there's a class? And once the court, I think, agrees that this one question versus two questions requires a remand to the district court, the court shouldn't try to figure out whether now in February of 2016 there is still a problem with class members suffering unnecessary pain. We finished the trial in June of 2014. District judge ruled in December of 2014. It's now 2016, and nobody knows with reliability what's happening at the jail now. Are the seven dentists still working half-time? Is there a shortage of nurses so that this practice of not doing face-to-face assessments has continued? I think what's required is to reverse the district judge's erroneous conclusion of law that if there's more than one question, you can't have a class, and send it back for further proceeding. Thank you.
Thank you.
Ms. Hannon?
May it please the court. The important thing we'd like to stress, Your Honors, is that the standard here is abuse of discretion. Judge Lefkow, the district court, heard six full days of testimony, and with due respect to counsel, his interpretation of what the testimony produced is incorrect. What she heard was eight detainees testify, seven CIRMAC employees, one sheriff's employee, and two dental experts say that there was no need for an injunction because there was no consistency in terms of being able to establish whether an individual had been treated not quickly enough. That is, the requirement for commonality could not have been met. There was adequate staffing in the dental program. There were adequate procedures in place to be able to treat the detainees. Among the detainees that testified at trial, they were seen with a face-to-face by a nurse. Quentin Scott, the second witness who took the stand, was seen by a nurse, a PA, the following day after his health service request form, and he was given Motrin. He saw the dentist 72 hours later after putting in his health service request form. He chose to have his teeth pulled out at Stroger instead of in the dental clinic. Orlando Allen was another witness who in the spring was delayed from health service request form to seeing the dentist, but that was because he moved from one division to another. In the fall, when Mr. Orlando put in a health service request form, he was seen by the NRN the following day and a dentist the following day who pulled his tooth. So the evidence deduced at trial was that we do have nurses who see these detainees within 24 hours of putting in their health service request forms. The other important factor was that the 14 witnesses who were the post-close of discovery declarants submitted by the plaintiff also had been seen within 24 hours by an RN. So the plaintiff's theory was debunked by their own evidence in the medical records in this case. I think it's very important to point out that the district court actually stated the witness testimony demonstrated that the treatment of dental pain may fall below the deliberate indifference threshold for many reasons and many stages of the treatment process. There are factual issues as to why there may have been a delay in treatment that are individualized. That's why she found that an injunction was not necessary. There was no longer any question about staffing being inadequate. Both experts said the staffing level is optimum.
Now, the plaintiffs are arguing that looking at the most recent medical monitor's report, there are significantly less patients receiving care on a daily basis than was represented at trial. What's your response to that? And also this, you know, seven half-time versus seven full-time.
I think that's a red herring, Your Honor. The evidence deduced at trial was based on the testimony of dentist Dr. Raven as well as the testimony of Dr. Alexander, the director of oral care, as well as the dental assistant, Tiffany Davenport, who all said their dentists see typically 15 patients a day. And that's 10 pre-scheduled patients and 5 openings in the afternoon for walk-ins, grievances, and emergencies of the dentist. The important fact to look at were the exhibits at the trial that showed how many procedures are done each year. The evidence was defendant's exhibit 6 at the trial. There are 13,000 procedures, 13,000 detainees who had a procedure done in the dental clinic during 2013 that cannot objectively be a systemic flaw in the dental. So whether the Department of Justice is analyzing based on Mr. Flaxman's math, and I didn't check his math, that they only saw 8 patients a day instead of 15, that still doesn't mean there's a systemic problem which would merit court intervention under the PLRA. Absolutely not. What it means is that we have 6 operating dental clinics at all times, so if someone were in acute pain, dental pain, they have an avenue to be seen. So I think it's a red herring.
Maybe you could talk for a moment about your brother's contention that the district court misapprehended the holding in the Walmart case.
I don't think in any way that the district court misapprehended. I think she was addressing the fact that originally she certified the B2 and the B3 class because she saw that there was some potential, one common issue, and that was inadequate staffing. In 2007, there was only one dentist for a short period of time. That condition, inadequate staffing, is absolutely no longer present, and there was no wavering her opinion on that issue, and the plaintiff's expert also conceded that there was not an issue about staffing. So I don't think in her opinion she said there must be one common issue and not 3 or not 5. She said there has to be at least one that would advance the litigation for purposes of the class. And I think he was using that as an argument to try to get your attention, frankly.
It's a principal argument in his brief, isn't it?
Yes, it is, Your Honor. And I don't think the district court concluded that in any way. I think that she thought that there was not one issue because the dental care and the reasons for the delay as well as the defenses for the delay are so unique that there is no common issue. There is no one common issue. You can't have an injunction that says you must see a detainee every time they put in a health service request form within 24 hours because things happen. And the way that he's asking is that a registered nurse see it. Our policy actually prevents any medical provider to read the health service request form. So it could be an MD, it could be a physician assistant, or it could be a nurse. But his narrow focus of this common question will not advance the litigation.
There's a great deal of discussion in the briefs about the institutional proceeding, the DOJ proceeding. Can you tell us where that proceeding is? There is an injunction in place, is that correct?
Yes, Your Honor. In 2010, the county and the sheriff entered into a consent decree with the Department of Justice, wherein the Department of Justice comes in every 6 months to evaluate the medical, psychiatric, and dental procedures in the Cook County Department of Corrections.
Has that consent decree been reduced to a judgment?
No, it's just an ongoing. Well, I guess we have agreed to abide by the provisions in the consent decree, and the monitors come in every 6 weeks. Six months.
I see. And what judge is overseeing that, if any?
Judge Kendall, Virginia Kendall.
Strange that this case wasn't assigned to her.
According to the plaintiff, they thought this was different and that they had the right to bring their own, and the district court agreed with the plaintiff that if they thought there was some ongoing violation, some constitutional impediment to the dental care, they could proceed on their own.
We've been seeing a decent number of cases where really you can make a very good argument that it's ancillary to a institutional litigation that's going on, but yet another judge gets it in that district, and we're getting a lot of it's just very hard to see a sane way to administer the decree that way.
Well, I think it is a nice catch-all that the Department of Corrections is there in there every 6 months to make sure that if there was some systemic flaw that it would be addressed. And I do think if the DOJ thought there was a problem, it could be addressed before Judge Kendall. And indeed, every 6 months when they do their analysis, the dental care is part of that analysis. So she does actually review that in some way. So it is under her directly, but despite
this. So you've got a right hand and a left hand in the Northern District of Indiana with respect to dental care now.
Yes.
In the jail.
There's a few more points I'd like to make, Your Honors, with respect to the discovery. The discovery was at the direction of the plaintiff. He drove all the discovery, and they did, I say he, but the plaintiff's counsel, focused on grievances for the first 2 years of their claim, I think in an effort to bolster their case. But the reality is the medical records are important. The medical records are the key because you can then analyze the totality of care and whether the plaintiffs are in fact being honest about their care. Many of the dentists testified at trial that they get the health service request forms that said, I have dental pain, bleeding gums. When they get in, it's actually, I just wanted to get my teeth cleaned. And it's actually my dentures need adhesive. How do I get that? So they aren't always honest. The lead plaintiff, Malcolm Patton, testified that he was not honest in his grievance when he had actually seen the dentist a month before and lied in his grievance and said he hadn't seen the dentist. So there is a pattern here of needing to look at the medical records to verify what the detainees are claiming.
Now, what about Mr. Flaxman saying that at least there was this one document that was introduced at trial that he didn't have access for, he hadn't received? Well, what's your comment on
that? And that's true. And Mr. Flaxman, the plaintiffs brought this injunction and demand to look at the current status of the dental clinic in January 2014 after discovery closed in 2013.
And why wouldn't that be relevant, given what the claim was that he...
Well, it became relevant once he asked the court for a hearing on the preliminary injunction about the current status of the jail, but there had been discovery ongoing from 2007 to the present. So which document would be relevant for his inquiry didn't come up until he raised it. In other words, he then challenged in January of 2015 that the scheduling was incorrect.
And so, but what I'm trying to get a handle on is when did he get the updated document? Like, was that before the trial started so he could make a request for discovery? Because that does have some relevance to the
litigation. Certainly, Your Honor. The document he's talking about was an email that he did not get until the morning of the trial. And it was an email from the Director of Oral Health to her employees that was crafted in September 2013 saying, we think we're going to modify the scheduling to keep open these five spots in the afternoon. And indeed, he did not get that until the morning of trial. But again, that wasn't ripe for an issue. He never asked for any emails between Dr. Jarrell or Alexander and her people. It was not on any of our radar until January when he filed this injunction. So there was no hardship, I guess, for him to not get that document at that point. Between January and June, when the trial occurred, Mr. Flaxman did get to take the deposition of five current CIRMAC employees who would be able to answer for him all of those questions. What is the current status? How many dentists work every day? What are their hours? How many detainees do they see? And all of those questions were answered, and he had an ample opportunity to get the discovery related to those depositions. He didn't only take five depositions. There were 17 depositions taken in this case before the injunction hearing and years of discovery. So I don't think it's fair when he argues that he was somehow hampered in discovery. But the nature of an injunction is that there'll always be another document. Every time one of the six dental clinics sees patients, there's a dental clinic log that is produced every day. And we did not feel that we had an ongoing duty every single time a piece of paper was generated in the dental department to give it to the plaintiff.
What's the status of this case came from Judge Lefkoe on that issue? What about Judge Kendall's case now? That's just a pending monitoring of this, or what?
Yes, Judge Kendall has the oversight of the entire Department of Corrections, healthcare, psychiatric
everything,
and dental. She has the whole kit and caboodle. And I forgive me, I'm not as familiar with that case other than the fact
that this is just part of that.
And the testimony adduced by the Director of Oral Care and the Head of Dentistry, Dr. Townsend, every 6 months when the monitors come in, they give advice to the dental clinic, which is part of why the form has changed over time and our procedures have changed over time, because the dental clinic actually follows the advice that is given by the medical monitors.
And so that procedure that Mr. Flaxman described, that they have to generate a piece of paper, and you may have inmates who are not very articulate, not good at writing things down. That's something the monitors recommended, that a piece of paper generate the treatment, versus some of those other situations where, you know, it's you get the one-on-one as soon as the request is made.
Yes, Your Honor. The health service request form, the document to start the ball rolling so that a patient gets non-emergency care, is always present. It always has been. We have followed the recommendations of the DOJ in terms of how to make it a checkbox as opposed to a handwritten mm-hmm. articulation of what their problem is.
And so that's what's being used now, the checkbox.
Yes. But they can also handwrite it. One page is English, the following page is Spanish, and they stamp it when they receive it. So,
as far as you're concerned, this case should be gone?
I do feel that way, Your Honor, and it's I agree with the district court that there is a common issue in terms of what the staffing was in 2007. I agree that that's a common issue, but I don't think a class action is ever appropriate because the other half, it's not superior. The individual medical care that each person got will always be an issue. There will always be defenses that the county medical providers will be able to produce. And I think it's easier, truly, for a detainee to bring a case on their own, to file it. It's easy to do a pro se. This isn't like suing Sears because your washing machine doesn't work, or suing Keurig because, or Sturm Foods because they messed up the coffee. This is very easy. This is a paragraph complaint that they file downstairs, and they get their relief. There's also 300 opt-outs already with this case, and that's part of the discovery below. So a class action isn't necessarily to benefit the parties either. We're still going to have 300 single cases if they choose to do that on their own. So I do not think a class action for dental care at this point or even as far back as 2007 is a superior method of adjudication, and I think they deserve the right to bring their own case. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Counsel. Mr. Flaxman?
Thank you.
How much time is it?
8 minutes.
I kept hearing my sister talk about superiority. Superiority is not part of Rule 23b-2. It's not part of Rule 23a. It's part of Rule 23b-3. The B-3 class is not before this court. There's no superiority requirement to get prospective declaratory or injunctive relief. Back in 2010, in the CRIPA litigation before Judge Kendall, the United States said that we're going to intend to ensure timely screening and analgesia through nursing triage of dental complaints. The evidence, that's from ECF number 45 in U.S. versus Cook County 10C2946, the CRIPA case. That's what we asked, that's what the evidence showed the jail was not doing at the time of trial. That's what we asked the district judge to order. It's not clear, well, I mean, Your Honor's suggestion that all of these cases should be before Judge Kendall because she has the CRIPA case. There were some cases, some class actions filed before Judge Kendall got the CRIPA case, and nobody thought about sending the CRIPA case to those other judges. I think this Northern District has this long tradition of random assignment and not allowing entities to misuse the relatedness, the related case filing. But the thing that I heard in my sister's argument was an attempt to run away from what the district judge said, when the district judge said that there can only be one question. At page 16, she said that there's no longer one common cause. And then the second and third question, we proposed three questions. The second and third question show that there's no longer a single question of causation. At page 17 to 18 of her decision, she wrote, there's no longer a common question that can be answered in the same proceeding. And then at page 17, she recited that the commonality requirement demands a single question of causation. I haven't heard any defense of that, and there is no defense of that. It's wrong.
Well, you agree, don't you, that there has to be individual fact determinations to determine whether existing policies were followed. And for some plaintiffs, the policies may have been followed. For others, they may have been ignored. And so it's hard to get a handle on which category and why and how you can lump all of them together.
But the way to prove a widespread practice is to show repeated instances of something happening, repeated instances where people file health service request forms and don't get seen by a nurse the next day, don't get seen by the dentist for a week or 2 weeks. To show entity liability or Monell liability when there isn't an express written policy or a policy made by a decision maker, it's the plaintiff's burden to show a widespread practice. That requires more than three instances. It requires, there's no number for it. It just requires that it be widespread. And that's what we sought to prove at the trial. And I think that's what we did prove. We proved that people were not getting seen by a registered nurse, even though the jail promised the United States of America in 2010 that it's going to do that. And we asked the district judge to require the defendants to follow their own policy. And the district judge did not have jurisdiction to do that once she decided or ruled that there could not be a class action. I think Judge Ripple might remember a case from 30 years ago where there was an attempt made to challenge a policy of the city of Chicago about arresting people and holding them for too long. And this court said, to get that kind of injunctive relief, you had to have filed it when you were in custody. Otherwise, the whole claim would be moot. And without mootness, we could not reach the merits. And then 20 years later, I think there was a consent decree which did away with that policy. But this is the same thing. Unless there's a class action, a duly certified class action, the district judge and this court lacks jurisdiction to say whether or not there should or should not be an injunction. And there should be a class action, and it should go back to the district judge to hold some hearings to find out what's going on now. Maybe a miracle has happened, and everybody at the jail is getting health care, is getting seen by a nurse the next day, and an injunction would not be necessary. But there are no representations of that. We heard about the CRIPA case and the medical monitor. It's important to note that in some CRIPA cases, and it's not a consent, I think it's referred to by this court as a consent decree in one of the, I think there's a three-judge court order, which I think Your Honor might have been part of, which the court referred to it as a consent decree. As a consent decree, the order in the CRIPA case is denominated an agreed order. And there's no dental monitor in that case. There's a medical monitor. In some other CRIPA cases, there are now dental monitors. The last CRIPA report, on which we rely in the Rule 60B motion, reported that dental grievances had increased in the same period at which the testimony at trial was that dental grievances had decreased. We were not given the dental grievances after November of 2013. We don't know. And there's no way of telling whether the CRIPA report is right or whether the witness who testified is right. My sister told you about the document, the email that was given to us in the middle of trial, where the director of health wrote that the current process for scheduling is inefficient, that return appointments as well as grievances, health service request forms are not being scheduled appropriately. That really undercuts the defense argument that we don't need any kind of injunction. And the final point is about the depth of the evaluation of the dental program, which appears in the trial transcript, which I believe you have at 1080 and then at 1095 to 1098. That's where Dr. Townsend talked about how he met with the medical monitor and the director of health, and they picked several dental files. They randomly picked several dental files. And when you look at the transcript, you'll see, I believe, that Dr. Townsend doesn't have the foggiest idea of what a random selection is. And if that's the way in which the CRIPA monitor is assessing the efficacy of the dental program at the jail, we're all in serious trouble. And I leave that to the court to look at. But this is the first question and that the court has to decide is, was the district judge right in saying that if you have more than one common question, you can't have a class action? The answer to that has to be no. Rule 23 says multiple questions. This court and every other court that's considered it has approved classes where there's more than one common question. And we presented two common questions that did not disentitle us to class certification. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Flaxman. Thanks to both counsel, and the case will be taken under advisement.